be in session. Thank you all for coming to our first organizing meeting of the committee. And I think while we're letting a couple of more members arrive, that it would be a really good way to start our session by introducing ourselves, and for those who want to, at least to say a couple of things about what we're hoping to accomplish this session. So, Representative Bruin, would you like to begin?
I would be honored, Mr. Chair. I'm Scott Bruin. I'm the state representative from House District 37, which is primarily Westland, Tualatin, Stafford area. This is my second session, and among sundry other goals, my biggest personal goal for this session and this committee would be to move along the path of comprehensive tax reform to make our tax system more stable and less burdensome on investment and workers in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Berger?
I'm Vicki Berger. I represent District 20, which is part of the Salem area. This is my third term and my third session on revenue. And my suggestion to freshmen on this committee is to get Paul Warner's phone number on speed dial. Just thought I'd make that.
Speaking of freshmen, Vice Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that advice, Representative Berger. I'm pleased to be sitting next to you.
He'll disappear on you, and you'll need his number.
Good to know in advance. I represent District 27, which is Beaverton, a little bit of southwest Portland, and some unincorporated Washington County, attempting to follow and maybe fill some of the big shoes of Representative Mark Haas. And I would echo some of the comments earlier. I've got a lot to learn, and I think stability would be a very good goal for us.
Great. Representative Gelser?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which is most of Corvallis and most of Philomath. I share with Representative Olson. And my goals this session would be to comprehensive tax reform that's fair and sustainable and allows us to provide the services that Oregonians count on.
That's good. That's good.
It is good.
All right.
Mr. Chair, my name is Andy Olson. I'm a state rep out of the Albany area, and this is my second time tour of duty as I look at this. I'm just joking. I enjoyed this last session, and looking forward to doing it again, especially with Mr. Warren. I mean, goodness.
Great. That's wonderful. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think I'm sort of an old-timer on this committee. This is my fifth session.
Wow.
And I served on revenue in my freshman session and have really been trying to get back here ever since. So it's a realization of a long-term aspiration of mine to be on this committee, although I did get a chance to serve with Representative Butler on the Joint Interim Committee on Tax Reform a few years ago and enjoyed that experience. I think for me, you know, in addition to the comments that others have made, I do think that there are there's a lot of work to be done on our revenue system in our state, and I think that we are in the fortunate position right now of having a little breathing room, which we haven't had for a while, so hopefully this can be a chance to take a look without feeling quite as pressured as we have in the past and make sure that we're looking off into the future and doing things that make it more fair, more stable, and more adequate.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're going to get tired of hearing this. I'm from House District 60, which is the largest district in the state. It's the most rural district in the state. It's the furthest district in the state away from the state capital. I'm closer to the state capitals in Montana and Idaho and Utah than I am to Salem, Oregon. And I'm almost closer to that of Carson City, Nevada. So, but it's a delight to be here. This is an opportunity for us to take a look at a chance to look at the overall tax structure, as Representative Bruin indicated, of the state of Oregon. One of my largest concerns in this session is the fact that we have ignored the effects of measures 547 and 50 on local government for far too long. As we swing the corner now on inflation and the cost of public employees, PERS system, and insurance costs to local government, we're finding that the local government is suffering from the effects of the inability to continue to deliver the vital services that we depend upon at the local government level. And certainly not the least of those is the public law 106-393, with the concerns that we've got with several of our counties faced with the municipal bankruptcies and the problem that could engender for us. So I'm very anxious that we take a look in the mirror and look at our own system, but make sure that while we've got nearly a 20% freeboard in this particular session, that we also make sure that while we're getting fat, dumb, and happy, that local governments are able to sustain operations to make sure that we've got police, fire, public safety, those kinds of things, as well as the services that we'd like to have available to us.
Thank you. And I'm Phil Barnhart. I represent House District 11. I started out in a very unusual way in the legislature in that I ran in South Eugene in old District 40 to replace Floyd Przanski, who'd been termed out of office by the old term limit law. During that session, the term limit law went away, and redistricting happened. And although Floyd and I only live maybe 3 miles apart, we ended up in different legislative districts. He ran for re-election in the old seat, which now is number 8, and I ran for election in a new district. The thing that was really impactful on me about that is that I went from an area, a very homogenous area, with people who agree with each other a lot about most public policy issues, to a very an area that's much more like the state of Oregon as a whole, although not obviously quite a bit smaller, including pieces of South Eugene, small towns like Cresswell and Brownsville, Coburg, tree lots, farms, and other rural folk, and much broader opinion. And so during the time I've been in the legislature, the past 6 years, I've learned a lot about how other people think about public policy. And it's been a great education, an important education for me. I was on this committee in 2003, serving with Lane Shetterly as chair, and I can tell you that he's my idol when it comes to running a committee. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that well, but I'm going to try. The committee, as I see it, has a lot of challenges this year. The legislature has a lot of challenges. Representative Butler has raised one of the important ones, I think, and that is, how are we going to fix a system that was essentially broken by Measure 5 and has really had very little attention since then in dealing with local revenue, so that counties, cities, school districts, special districts, and others have the revenue they need to provide the services that the people in those jurisdictions need and demand. Other areas include the issue of tax fairness that several people have raised, the business of stability, which I think is going to be one of the issues we're going to have to come to fairly early in the session, probably talking about things like an emergency reserve account, something of that sort. And of course tax fairness, which is different depending upon who's talking about it at the time. So today, what I'm hoping that we're going to do is to go through this agenda, discuss the rules, adopt them if we're able to, and then do an overview of the revenue system. A discussion of the of the work plan I guess we'll do that second. The work plan's been distributed. So I think first what we'll do is
show up in the work session on the rules. Mm-hmm. If I do.
I'm thinking about just kind of just to stay on.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to introduce the committee. Those of you, of course, many of you have worked with us extensively in the past, but for those of you who haven't, a complete listing of your revenue staff is in your public finance basic facts. The second page in gives you an organizational chart. There's organizational chart of how we're structured as your staff. Of course, our chairs, Representative Barnhart and Senator Deckert, are my appointing authorities in statute. And the staff that my staff of economists, all four of them are listed there, and they specialize in particular areas. So unlike the other policy committees where you get a committee administrator that basically administers all the bills, my economists will serve as a committee administrator for each of their individual areas. So if you get a property tax bill, for example, Mary Ayala will be the administrator for that bill. She'll do the impact analysis, and she'll be up here with you and answer questions and help you develop amendments and so forth in that area. And you can see the rest of our staff. Everyone was here last session with the exception of Chris Alanak, who is our income tax economist, and he came over from the Department of Revenue, where he worked with them for 10 years over there in revenue research. Our office manager is Robin Wilton. Robin is here. Robin, this is her first session with us. Last session she was with the Senate, Secretary of the Senate. Her father, John Schoon, I think is the longest serving consecutive member of House Revenue. I think he was on 10 consecutive sessions in House Revenue. So she's seen this committee work for a long time. And then Carol Phillips is your committee assistant. And Carol has been with us two previous sessions. So she's very experienced. And Barbara Gardino is here. Barbara won't be working with you too much directly. She's our Senate committee assistant. But you'll find, of course, with the two committees' bills, you'll be seeing a lot of the same bills. So we kind of work together with the Senate as well. So we welcome all of you, those some of you back and some of you for the first time.
Bravo. All right. Thank you very much. Let's open a work session on the draft committee rules, see if we can deal with those today. The rules are, the proposed rules, the draft rules, are essentially the rules proposed by the clerk of the House in consultation with the speaker. I think if you take a minute to review them, you'll see that they're very similar to rules that those of you who've been here before have seen in most committees. We take a couple minutes to read them if you like.
Mr. Chair, relative to the
Representative
couple of, thank you, Mr. Chair. The relative to the Scrivener issues that you and I had talked about immediately preceding this meeting today, I am concerned with the potential for a misunderstanding, and I think that as long as it's on the public record, I think we'll know who the various chairs are, because it provides in paragraph 3 that the chair shall call committee meetings and set agendas, but then it also talks about that the speaker may have a subcommittee which shall appoint a subcommittee chair, and it doesn't say subcommittee chair, but it'll appoint the chair, because down number 5 it says the chair shall be an ex officio member of all of the subcommittees, and that's yourself as the chair of revenue certainly would be an ex officio member of each of the subcommittees. The concern is brought about by the fact that in the middle of the fourth paragraph it talks about the chair being a capitalized chair, and I believe that that means yourself as the chair of the full committee. At any time may remove a measure from a subcommittee or assign that measure to another committee, or to the full committee. So I think that just with that understanding, that it talks about a couple of different chairs, and then in number 6 it talks about notice of any full committee. Well, there's only one full committee, so this is the full committee, basically, as opposed to any, or any subcommittee, because there, now there can be multiple subcommittees of the meeting of the sub, of any of the subcommittee meetings, then could continue with hearings and work sessions, or both. The testimony can be taken and so forth. I just wanted to make sure, and then when it comes down, I think number 8 continues to talk about the chair may set a time on, and that would be yourself or the subcommittee chair, really. Mm-hmm. Any of the chairs could set times on testimony. And then I think that relative to these rules, actually the only new rule that I recognized was that and Representative Riley was a member of the Ways and Means, or I'm sorry, the House Revenue Committee last session, and we served on a governor's task force in the interim to discuss the fact that we've got a lot of measures being introduced that have tax credits that, number one, don't have any kind of a sunset or a look-back provision on them, and number two, we ask about the performance of tax credits. Are they really, is the socioeconomic purpose of a tax credit really accomplishing what it was sent out to accomplish? A member of the House today contacted me to ask me to sign on to a bill, and a tax credit bill, and I recommended two changes immediately. Number one, that there be some sunset to the bill, and because that's what we want to have in it. And number two, that she go ahead and outline what the policy purpose of the bill was going to be. This one happened to be for paramedics and those kinds of things, volunteer firefighters and paramedics in rural Oregon. So I think that she went away, headed back to legislative council to go ahead and make sure that was redrafted, and she'd already talked to you about it with regard to the broad relating clause relating to tax credits, and you'd invited her to go ahead and kind of winnow that down just a little bit to keep it from being broadly defined there. But this newest edition, number 16, I beg your pardon, I think brings in part what it was that we worked in the interim committee with the governor's office to try and define the public policy purpose of each of the tax credits or the legislation that we might try to offer to spur up some kind of economic interest in Oregon to develop more jobs and those kinds of things.
Thank you. This is the only item that's different, isn't it?
Yes.
From the standard model rules?
Right, Mr. Chair. The number 16 is unique to the Revenue Committee, and it grew out of the interim work that Representative Butler referred to, and what it is in response to it was the 95 Revenue Committees that developed the tax expenditure report requirement for Department of Revenue, and one of the requirements for state agencies is to answer the question: is this tax expenditure meeting its public policy purpose? And so, what the joint work group asked us to do during the interim was to look through those statutes and see which ones had a policy statement in them, and virtually none of them did. So that was where that came from, the idea that there'd be a policy statement for the purpose of that. If nothing else, to lend some direction to state agencies when they're evaluating those tax expenditures at a later time to see if they're meeting what the true legislative intent was.
So this would be the place where the benchmark would go, against which we would measure whether the tax expenditure was successful meeting its goal or not.
That's correct. And what this rule says is that you as a committee, if you adopt this, agree not to approve any measure for the floor, any tax expenditure increase or sunset extension or new one, without putting in that, without the bill having that statement in it in some form.
Okay. So if we adopt this rule, then one of our jobs is to make sure that proponents are prepared to give us that rationale so that it can be put into the bill. Thank you. Other comments on
if I might add to
the discussion,
Chair,
yes.
The Senate is planning to adopt, or will be looking at a similar rule as well for their revenue committee.
Great. Other discussion? Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, there was one other Scrivener issue, that, and that would just be to take out the comma at the from the third word, from the end of the line on second line on number four. That comma is misplaced there. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'm proposed to prepared to make a motion that the committee accept the rules with the slight Scrivener and with addition or modification as those rules have been prepared or presented and discussed by us today.
Thank you. Is there further discussion of the motion made by Representative Butler to adopt the rules? Hearing none, is this one we need to take a roll call on? Don't need to. Are there any objections to the adoption of the rules, essentially as printed? Thank you. The rules are adopted. Let's go on to a discussion of the work plan. In front of you, you should find a draft version of the House Revenue Committee work plan. Intended to be as a part of that work plan is a proposed schedule for the first month, which is a separate document. Let me just describe briefly that I met with Senator Deckert and Mr. Werner before session to begin discussion of some of these issues. The work plan came out of arose out of that discussion, and it presupposes that we're going to spend a fair amount of time in January sort of preparing to do our work. We have some new members who need to be brought up to speed with the complex subject of taxation, but I also should tell you that as we talk about this, that the issues that we're going to deal with are going to require a great deal of time and attention, and so it isn't going to be clean, I think, in the sense that we're going to be able to move from one segment of our work to another, but they'll probably be intermixed a bit. And having said that, I'll ask Mr. Werner to introduce the work plan.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The introduction part of this is we try to write down some criteria for you to think about and looking at proposals, and this really grows out of kind of the standard taxation and public finance criteria that look at how the tax may affect the economy, how it may affect the distribution of income, how it affects competitiveness of different industries, how it can be administered, and so forth. So that's just to give you a little bit of background in terms of a thought process for looking at the various proposals you'll be seeing. On the major themes, the chairs looked at a series of issues and kind of talked about these as really being the most prominent that appear right now. Of course, recognizing that things can change and issues can emerge on you in the next 6 months that you don't anticipate. The first one, of course, is a series of proposals that the governor has talked about in terms of excise tax on cigarettes and other tobacco products and changes in the state corporate minimum tax. Those bills, of course, will have to originate here on the House side, and we've seen drafts of those in various forms, and those will be on their way to the committee. The chair has also talked about a broader set of issues, excise tax issues, that could involve taxation of other types of activities. Beer and wine is one that we've seen a lot of proposals come through on, and so we would anticipate those bills. And then the issue of the corporate minimum tax suggests a way of looking at business taxation beyond net income. Right now with the corporate income tax, if your net income is zero, then you pay zero tax. So the corporate minimum suggests an alternative way of looking at things, and I think the chairs agree that that opens a wider issue of talking about, gee, what is the best way to tax business in a way that can meet the criteria that you've laid out before. So that means we would anticipate and have heard discussions of perhaps some broader proposals as well as just the corporate minimum. The second issue is on the federal response to federal timber payments. The interim House Revenue Committee spent a good deal of time with the counties going through what that issue is. The sunset of PL 106393 will leave a very large hole in a number of county budgets, particularly on the west side here, Josephine County, Curry County, Lane County, Jackson County, Douglas County, all hit very hard by this. And these counties have had a property tax structure basically frozen in place by Measure 50 that presupposes those federal timber payments. And so there's very little room for them to respond to a changed revenue environment. So the counties have been trying to look at options, and they'll be preparing some things for you to look at. And so we would suspect that that could be an issue that would encourage you to look at the overall revenue system and get at some of the issues that Representative Butler raised earlier in terms of how the local revenue system is working. So we would anticipate a number of bills in that area. The third major area is on kicker reform and reserve funds. There's a lot of proposals around the corporate surplus kicker credit. I've got a research report on the kicker that is almost done, and I'll have that to you probably either Friday or next Tuesday. So that's kind of for those of you who have insomnia, so it'd be a good document to have. But it kind of goes through the whole history of the kicker, and we try to look at some of the impact issues and so forth. But I think the other issue that comes up, of course, is if there is a repeal of the kicker credits or refunds, then what to do with those funds. And that usually revolves around some discussion over an emergency fund or a reserve fund, as the chair talked about. We have a series of proposals on energy incentives that we've seen bills come through from the governor's office, but we anticipate others as well to encourage development of alternative energy sources. We know there's some proposals to modify the business energy tax credit, for example, to stimulate biofuel production. Those bills will be headed here. Probably will go to policy committees initially and then come here for the revenue, for you to analyze the revenue part of it. And the chairs will be meeting on a regular basis to talk about the bills in the Senate and as well. And the proposals we anticipate coming starting in the Senate, I've got listed there. We had spent a lot of time, both committees, both House and Senate, on income tax compliance last time. The Senate's got a set of bills to look at that again. They're also spent a lot of time in the interim on affordable housing and looking at alternative ways to provide funding there. And then school capital needs is an issue that they've spent a lot of time on. So I would anticipate those coming a little later in the session.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, relative to the affordable housing, there's at least one proposal that we heard in the interim relative to new filing fees. That would have to originate in the House, would it not?
Representative Butler, that would depend on how those funds are used for general purposes versus it's the debate between whether it's a broad revenue-raising effort or a fee determined for a highly specific purpose.
I see. So a fee may not have to be a specific fee for housing may not have to actually be considered as a state revenue.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
For general purposes, yes.
Right. Good, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On the third page there of the draft document, I've listed a series of things that those of you who have been on Revenue Committee are familiar with, that the committee sometimes can turn into major issues, but there's always something in these areas. Sunset extensions, there's a list of sunset extensions recommended by the governor on page 7 of your tax expenditure book, which we provided for you. We have several box loads of those, so if you lose one, we'll provide one at half price.
No excuses not to have your book.
So, but that's an issue that typically comes up. We do have a series, in fact, so we got our first committee bills this morning, and they were bills that were introduced by the interim House committee from the tax collectors on collecting property taxes. So you'll be getting those kinds of administrative bills from both the assessors and the tax collectors. We also work very closely with the Department of Revenue. And in fact, their staff who work with us, who drew the short straws and have to spend their time with us in the legislature, are John Phillips is on the property tax issues, and Deborah Buchanan, who does income, corporate, and personal. So we see them almost an extension of our staff, and they do a great job in helping us and helping you.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, delightful and intelligent people. It's wonderful. Surround yourself with people that are very intelligent. It makes you look a lot better, too.
We hope. Thank you, Representative Butler.
The other perennial favorite is the connection to federal income tax laws. The department has introduced a bill on that, so that'll be coming your way as well. And then, of course, the school fund distribution formula. We often get proposals in that area, and Steve Meyer will be talking with you about that tomorrow. We thought we'd start out with the school finance, and Steve is really the most knowledgeable person probably in the state on the school distribution formula and other school finance issues. Timeline and process, the chair and I talked a good deal about this and trying to fit this into the framework that the Senate has adopted in SCR 1 and looking at specific dates, and we've tried to kind of fit that to that framework. We would anticipate a couple of things that I would emphasize for you is committee bill introduction request for the bill draft request deadline is January 29. So if there are bills that you want to request, either individually or potential committee bills, make sure you have those requests in by then. And then the council will be heavily involved in that drafting process, and so by the end of February will be the deadline for committee bill introduction. So the committee and the chair has instructed me to have a series of days where we have possible bill introduction. We'll put those on the schedule. So the committee, as those bills come through, you'll have those bills for further work.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Let me just make sure that I understand at that point. The bills that would be acceptable to yourself for committee introduction would have mostly some relationship to revenue issues, or could they be around the peripheral edges, nibble around the edges?
That question I hadn't thought of, but I guess I was assuming that we were talking about issues that were primarily revenue related, although it's possible, I suppose, that they could be substantively related, but bills that would come back to revenue for consideration of the piece that involved the area of our responsibility. It is my plan, my thought, that I would try to follow the plan that Representative Shetterly used in 03, and that was to consider a wide range of revenue-related bills as potential committee bills. It simply makes the committee's work a little easier if we have vehicles available to do our work. And so I would encourage members and others who are interested in revenue bills to consider whether they want to submit bills themselves or whether they'd like the committee to consider that as committee bills.
And Mr. Chair, I think the policy in the past has been basically any of the members that bring a bill in to you for introduction into the committee could certainly be deemed to be revenue in nature, whether it is directly or not, whether it would ever be assigned to our committee for consideration.
Well, I think I'd be prepared to look at bills that might not be revenue related, but I think we're talking primarily about revenue related bills. As you know, Representative Butler, our past practice has been to introduce bills based on courtesy, without a substantial review of the contents of the bill, with the understanding that the other normal rules apply, so that sure. Voting to sponsor a bill as a committee bill does not imply that one supports the contents of the bill.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. You'd hate to have to assimilate those bills and then move them in the process with folks voting on them here as to whether or not we like them or don't. And,
right.
And so without regard to partisan politics, it's been the policy in the past to basically assemble those bills in committee and say, okay, these are committee bills, vote them back to the Speaker of the House, and then the Speaker can assign them or not to whichever committees they desire.
Right. Thank you, Representative.
Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The remainder of the outline there, you can see we always title the March, title it the March revenue forecast. Usually comes out late February. This year, however, it will be out on 1st of March. So you can anticipate that for your schedules. And what we typically do on this is have that released in the morning, and we'll try to arrange a meeting with the Senate at that time for that March 1st. So that's something for your schedules. That, of course, is not the forecast that the budget is finalized to, but it does give you a very good feel on kind of what direction we're going compared to where the governor's budget, what assumptions that was based on. In March, you have basically work on House and Senate bills, and then May 15 would be the revenue forecast that kind of sets off that final process. Usually the forecast that the legislature will balance to, the statute just says you balance to the latest forecast. So if you're here past September 1, then it would be the September 1 forecast, but hopefully it will be the May 15. And this committee is one of the committees listed that would not be necessarily closed on the date specified in SCR 1, because there are occasions in balancing the budget, the revenue committees have to take actions and consider revenue bills. So there is a possibility that there would be some further work after May 15. Of course, there's conference committees and then beginning to identify the interim committee bills. And in the framework that's been laid out in SCR 1, you'd begin to do that interim work in the fall of 07.
Thank you. Just on that last point, Senator Deckert and the co-chairs of Ways and Means and I have had some very preliminary conversations about trying to coordinate revenue and expenditures. One of the big flaws in our structure as a legislature is that we seem to consider revenue in isolation from the budget, and the budget in isolation from revenue, except on that one number which they're required to follow. And so we're going to see if there are some ways that we can do a better job of comparing our revenue situation with the budget needs, and do it in a way that involves the committees rather than simply doing it at a chair's level. I'm not sure quite how that's going to work out yet, but that's our plan, at least at this point. I may even ask the Ways and Means co-chairs if they're interested, and if Senator Deckert is interested, to sit with us for the revenue forecast so we can start the conversation then. But that's a topic for another day, but I think it's an issue that the legislature has never fully dealt with, and I know Representative Butler and others have raised this issue as well, so it's nothing new to talk about it. Other conversation or issues around the draft plan. We'll vote on this tomorrow, so you have the night to think on it. But mm-hmm. Other comments or thoughts now?
Can go by proxy, Mr. Chair.
No, I'll be.
I was going to give my proxy to Representative Rosenbaum.
Oh, that'd be yeah. All right. You know the rule.
Would that be a standing proxy? Or?
You know what? It would be probably a sitting proxy, I would think.
Thank you. Well, if there's no conversation now, if people, if as you review this, you have comments or thoughts overnight, get in touch with Mr. Warner, myself, and be prepared to talk about potential amendments if you have them tomorrow. But our plan, at least, is to adopt this as a plan. Now, as a plan, we're not wedded to it in the sense that we can't deviate from it, but it is sort of gives you an idea of where we're going. So if you have other thoughts about what we ought to be looking at, or you have strong objections to these topics,
I think it'd be useful for us to talk about that. Okay? Shall we go on to...
Did you want to say anything on the schedule?
I'm sorry. The schedule is a piece of the plan.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, that's kind of... you know, it's firm through Wednesday. We haven't posted Tuesday, Wednesday. Monday, no meeting. School finance tomorrow. And then Monday, no meeting. And then Tuesday, property tax. And Wednesday, the personal income tax. Tentatively, we have set a joint meeting with the Senate and ask for governor's staff to come in and talk about kind of the governor's proposals in a general kind of policy sense. So we're that's still in the works, so we'll finalize that. And then the chair wanted us to get back together at 1, and I did talk with our lottery director, Dale Penn, and he'll be available to come and talk about some lottery policy issues, and our staff will go through the lottery numbers with you and talk about the trends there and kind of where that revenue source is doing. And then next Friday we would have, we've asked Department of Revenue Director Elizabeth Archenko to come over and go through the revenue system from an administration standpoint. And they did this last session. I think it worked well to have that kind of an overview. That gives you a sense about what they do and how they administer the taxes that you make the policy decisions on. And then the rest of it is basically completing our orientation process. We have a joint meeting Thursday the 25th. We're working on with the Senate, and but at this point we would be ready by February 1st to start to talk about specific bills. I say we've already got some in committee now, and also to continue discussion of some of your bigger issues that you're going to be doing a lot of work on in the session.
And just to follow up on that, because of the amount of business we have, we're going to try to intersperse other issues as time allows on these days. Certainly, bill introductions, which because they usually don't take very long, and it's possible that we may be dealing with special election issues, and therefore want to get started on some particular bills, especially related to constitutional amendments. Because of the potential, at this point it's only potential, of a special election involving Measure 37. And if that happens, it would be good for us to be ready to piggyback other issues that are related to the constitutional changes that have to go to the voters. But that's speculative at this point. We'll know more about that later. And Mr. Warner is moving, so he can move us, get us to the next topic, an overview of the revenue system. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to fire up my computer. One other thing I wanted to mention is you have your 2007, hot off the press, we just finished this yesterday, version of our basic facts, and of course a lot of you are familiar with that, but it is a good, what I found, one of the things that's really difficult to find on revenue budget data is historical series, so you can look back in time, and so what we try to do is continually update those tables.
Oh, your password's the same as mine, Paul.
All those dots.
Yeah.
How did you? You know what it is. What it pertains. What we have in the first part of our public finance document is a kind of an overview of the revenue system, and so. What I tried to do is put together a real brief summary for you just to get us started in terms of kind of the biggest picture to look at the system before you and then to look at the major pieces, the school finance, property tax, income tax pieces, and start to look at those. But this is really to try to give you kind of some sense of the overall system. And some of these parts of this were in the new member orientation. Representative Reed was in on, and Representative Gelser was there. So some of this is a little redundant for you, but feel free to answer any questions or ask any questions you have.
And what I've tried to do is address three issues here. We're continually asked how our revenue system compares with other states, and of course, that's important in the sense that we think that tax policy does, at some point, does influence how a state grows economically and where people live, particularly if you have a tax system's a lot different than others, especially a lot different than your neighbor, for example, in which, of course, we have that situation, and we think that does significantly affect revenue trends. For example, we think we got a fairly healthy jump in cigarette tax revenue last year, and we think one of the reasons is that Washington raised their cigarette tax. So we get those kinds of interactions, but also just in terms of the general location of economic activity. And, of course, it also gives you a way to compare things like stability. We're asked to compare, is one system more stable than another, and we can look historically and how those different systems have worked. How has our system performed in the past? And, of course, looking ahead, what do we anticipate? This is the broadest definition of revenue that we can have, and one we won't turn to too much, although it is kind of reflective in the state level of the all funds budget that you see in the document that the governor produces and that Ways and Means publishes, an all funds revenue number. But these are the sources, state and local, so it's even broader from all revenue sources defined by the census. And they categorize things into these different categories. The first is taxes, and the first thing you notice is taxes here are less than a third of all revenue. So there are a lot of other revenue sources, and I've talked with the Senate about this, looking at some of the other revenue sources beyond taxes that can be significant in a policy sense. Intergovernmental revenue from the federal government, of course, including timber receipts now, a big issue discussed. Charges for services. You can see Oregon is quite high in charges for services. The largest category there is tuition. So tuition is, if you look nationally, is the biggest charge for services on higher education, not just tuition, but all charges. So that's an important variable there that's the difference between states. Miscellaneous and government enterprises. I've included government enterprises would include OLCC, but miscellaneous includes lottery revenue. And we rank relatively high in that category. This one is a bit of a distortion now because of the year that we're looking at. Insurance trust is public employee retirement system, workers' compensation, and unemployment compensation. The biggest category is public employee retirement. This number has traditionally been about 15 or so in our rank. It jumped up to 3 because the pension obligation bonds that were sold in that fiscal year show up as a revenue item. So that was authorized by the 03 legislature, you may remember that. And so that big dollop of revenue was put into the system and kind of distorts the numbers. It does push our total for all revenue.
And that is most of that number, isn't it?
That's a big, big chunk of it, Mr. Chair, yes. Well, I think the number is around, I'll have to look back, I think the previous number was about $1,000 per capita. So it caused a tripling of it, basically.
Yeah.
There is a wide variation, though, in that category. And we see it, some states, in fact, even are in a situation where they have a revenue outflow. This one thing to keep in mind about insurance trust, though, too, is current revenue. It's not an actuarial calculation. So the all revenue includes everything. The state ranks 7th. Because of this big number here, but if you use general revenue, which excludes insurance trust revenue, the state's about in the middle, 28th. So we have relatively low taxes at 32. We're about in the middle here. We used to be relatively high here, and we're high here. Now, if you narrow it to taxes and break down this $2,900 per person, of course, the personal income tax and the property tax are overwhelmingly the biggest pieces. Corporate is $89 per person. Selective sales taxes, which I think you'll be asked to look at some proposals in that area. Interestingly, it's $282 for 42nd on a per capita basis. And our sales taxes were 47th. Alaska doesn't have a sales tax, but they have some general gross receipts dollars, the census count. So they're actually 46th. So we're tied here with with Delaware, Montana, and New Hampshire for zero, with zero per capita. But if you add these two numbers together in terms of consumption taxes, we're 50th. Sales plus selective. Selective, by the way, is cigarette, any kind of alcoholic beverages, gasoline. And other taxes out here, we do have our weight mile tax show up over here in this other taxes. So if you look at our tax burden on a per capita basis, we're 32nd. As a percent of income, there are eight states with a lower percent of income. And this, is, of course, is a legacy of the property tax initiatives in the 90s.
Paul, would you identify that for us? Define that. Per capita just means if you just divide by the number of people in the state. Mm-hmm. And based on income, is it based on the the dollars that people earn?
Yeah, well, not necessarily earnings. The per capita, we just take the 3.6 million residents in the census and divide total collections by that number. The personal income is calculated by the Department of Commerce for each state. And it is current income. So wages and salaries are about 60%, but it includes dividends, interest, and rent, transfer payments, like Social Security. It does not, interestingly, include capital gains, because that's not considered income from current activities. It's an appreciation of assets. So that is not in there. But it's really the best measure we have for economic activity in the state. So we use personal income. We wish we had, there is a gross state product series, but it isn't updated as much and it's just not used as much. If you look at most of the spending limits, for example, of the states, usually are tied to personal income, that same series.
As is ours.
As is ours, correct. What I've done here is narrow the definition of taxes to state only. So I dropped the property tax. And you can see that when we look at our system, it's very unbalanced with personal income taxes, about 71%. And as many of you know, this is, if we did this, you know, this chart for all the states, this would be the highest bar. So it's 71. The second highest would be about 63%, which is Washington on the sales tax. Most, you can see if you look at, on average, it's pretty balanced. Of course, there's a lot of differences, but if you sum up all the states, they're about the same, interestingly, in sales and income taxes. What happens during expansions, the income tax goes ahead. During recessions, the sales tax catches up. if we look at the other western states, you can see that there is not really necessarily a right way to do tax system, because everybody does it a lot different. And in fact, in your summary in your packets, I added Montana, which is on table 3 there, on page A3. I added Montana so you can see another state without a sales tax. And there, interestingly, their reliance on the income tax is a lot less than ours, even though they don't have a sales tax, because they have a statewide property tax, and they have a lot higher reliance on excise taxes. But again, you can see if you look at kind of across the region, Oregon has a lower tax here. And these numbers add up. For example, if we were to impose the Idaho burden, these are 04, 05. If we were to impose the Idaho tax burden, $2,054 per person, on Oregon residents, 3.6 million, we'd come up with almost $1 billion a year difference in terms of tax collections on a per capita basis. So from that, about $300 per person. Personal income stands out. Corporate about $100 here, and you can see California is a lot higher tax. California has by far the highest taxes in the region. Nevada has a relatively high, has a higher tax burden, but one of the problems with these kind of comparisons is you have to ask, is it really Nevadans that are paying that tax? Because they've got a lot of money down here in excise taxes, which includes the gross gaming receipts, 6% of gross gaming receipts, which is probably a small percentage is paid by Nevadans. It's paid by tourists, you know, in the form of the prices they pay at the casinos. So Washington, again, you can see their unbalanced system, and they do have more reliance on these other taxes and excise taxes. kind of a history. It's at the end of kind of looking at how our system has changed. This is probably the one that most captures the changes, because this affected not only that where the revenue comes from and stability and so forth and taxpayers, but it really affected the levels of government. And this, of course, is really what put you in the position of largely determining the state, determining school budgets, the size of the amount of money spent on K-12, as personal income taxes took over as the primary source of revenue for schools. You can also see where the here's the peak, here's the drop. This was exacerbated by the last kicker in 2001. It was paid out $256 million. But also you can see the drop caused by the basically the stock market collapse in 2000 and the sharp and the impact of the recession. Now look, of course, where we are now as we appear headed up. And, you know, I think the message here on the income tax over time, this is a very powerful revenue generator. Very powerful. But, of course, it's not stable. Whereas the property tax become a lot more stable. This is measure 5. Goes up. Here's the jump. These were the bill, tax bills that were mailed November of 96, shortly before the measure 47 was voted on. Here's the first stage of measure 47, and then on up the, we've grown about 5% or so on the property tax, 3% plus about 2% statewide on new construction. The impact of measure 5, of course, was on rates, and you'll see that I'll be dealing with that limit, $15 per thousand, $5 schools, $10 for non-schools. And you can go above that rate for capital bonding purposes. Pretty strict definition of capital. But you can see on a statewide average, we're slightly above the $15. But it essentially acts as a rate cap around 15. Now, remember that Measure 5 applied to market value, not assessed value. It was equal to market value. What happened during the phase in of Measure 5 was we had a very strong real estate market. Residential property was growing 10 to 12% a year. So people, even though they got lower rates, were not getting much property tax relief. We're disappointed in the results of Measure 5. And the result was Measure 50, which separated assessed value and market value. And here's there was a cut and cap provision that dropped the assessed values back to 95, 96 and reduced them to 90%. So over time, this line here, which is limited by the 3% on existing property, will drop further behind this red line. One thing to emphasize, though, especially if you start to really look into the impact on local governments of the timber receipt decline, is that they're in a lot different position in terms of how much gap there is in those two lines. If you've had a lot of real estate value growth, your black line, or your red line, excuse me, for your county could be well ahead of the black line. If, as in some areas in eastern Oregon, for example, in Representative Butler's district, you don't have a lot of market growth, these lines are a lot closer together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But in total, it appears that we're about $100 billion separating RMV from RV.
That's correct. Representative Butler, I think we're...
From AV, rather.
Mary will probably have the precise number for you, but I think we're a little over 70% is the ratio of assessed value to market value on a statewide basis.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
But it appears from the graph, Paul, that those numbers are separating. There's more RMV than there is actual AV, which continues to give that huge amount of, if you will, property tax relief under here Measure 50 that could be constitutionally amended to allow local governments to come back in, and if the local citizenry voted, again, it would require a constitutional amendment, but if local citizens agreed that they could use a portion of their real market value above what the assessed value is in order to address public safety and other needs in their communities, that would be one potential source of income that the people still would not be paying more than the 1.5% of Measure 5 on their property value, but they would be capturing a portion of the real market value above assessed value as prescribed by Measure 50.
One of the additional complicated...
Representative Gelsa?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair Procco, on the gap, that is the gap that local school districts can do that function that Representative Butler just mentioned, to tax on that gap between the assessed and the real market value. As those continue to climb, is there some sort of a cap on what school districts will pull in, or will they continue to see additional revenue on measures that are passed as that real market value expands?
Representative Gelsey, yeah, that is a rough approximation of what local school districts can get through a local option. They have to stay consistent with the Measure 5 limit, and they can go above the Measure 50 and capture some of the revenue in the gap. A couple of things. There is a limit on them. They are limited to 15% of their operating revenue or a dollar limit, $750 per student. So we do have a limit for equity purposes.
Yes, sir.
In which you can't go above, even if you've got that more dollars out there in your property tax base and voters approve, you still have a limit for equity purposes, how you can go above the statewide averages. So that's both on a per-student basis and a percent of your budget. The other thing that to keep in mind about this, and this Corvallis is a good example because the Corvallis School District was one of the first districts to go out and use the local option when the legislature approved it in 99, is that these limits are all on a per property basis. So, you know, your property may be, at 70% of market value, where your neighbors may be at 95%. So when there's a local option approved, that person's 95, he's got a real limit. He can't go above his Measure 5 limit, whereas the 70% person would pay the full amount of the rate. And what we found, and I'm sure you've found this in your districts, very hard to explain that to taxpayers because they are getting, because of their assessment ratios, they're affected differently by these local options. So that's been one of the issues. And I know, for example, Chalkboard looked at the local property tax option. One of the arguments is it's almost unworkable in its current framework because of that individual property interpretation.
Follow up.
Yes.
I think that people in my community would say that was true. I know that there was a recent local option levy this fall, and it was very difficult for people to decide whether or not they could afford to vote yes or no on that measure, because for some people the increased tax burden was $0, and for other people that may have a home of a lesser value than that person that had no additional tax bill, mm-hmm. It might have been $300.
Mm-hmm. My only thing I might say here too, and this is, I think, goes back to Representative Butler's comments, is that, you know, and this, as the state economist will tell you, when you talk about the forecast, we've been in a housing boom. So that means those market values have really been rising rapidly in some areas of the state, and that's really accelerated that gap. And I don't, you know, our market value, the assessors, and this, you know, talk with them about this when they're here, is that, you know, they're not only do they do your assessed value, but they're supposed to keep track of market value as well. So that's where we get this data from. But that gap will widen as those home prices, you know, are growing. We're estimating about 17% in 2006 on a statewide basis.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Paul
Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, it really doesn't make a great deal of difference to any of the property tax assessment issues unless you had the schools that could borrow on the amount of real market value and excess of assessed value, but the assessors, I guess, will tell us why it's most important that the RMVs are always as close to accurate as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that statewide, this issue of RMV is really all over the board. I see property which, and I mentioned this last session, in Philomath, there's a sign that says assessed or real market value $365,000, for sale for $265,000. You know, buyer takes all offers. You know, the concern, and I had that on a property this past year where I got an increase in value on the land by about $200,000 increase in the value of the land. And I'm looking at that and I'm saying, it really doesn't make any difference to me one way or the other, because I'm just paying on the assessed value. But then when I got my November tax statement, they whacked $100,000 off of the increase that they put on before, the year before. What's the incentive and the disincentive of having that RMV wildly out of whack? And again, our assessors will probably have the answer to that as well.
I would say that certainly in terms of making the system work year to year, they have less incentive to get the market value as accurate as they did in the past. I mean, that's kind of obvious because that was their tax base and what they had to assess on. But having said that, they still have a lot of strong incentives to keep that market value right. Remember, it is a dual calculation. You compare your real market value with your maximum assessed value, MAV, under Measure 50, and for the taxpayer, you're paying the lesser of those two. So that calculation should always be there. Of course, a lot of properties that may come into play. So that needs to be there for that purpose. And as we've just talked about, for the local option, that becomes a critical variable because it is the measure of for Measure 5 limits. I mean, that's what Measure 5 is based on. So the assessors have plenty of incentives to get that number right. I don't think on a day-to-day basis probably quite as intense as it was before, but it's still pretty powerful in the system.
Thank you. That's responsive.
This, of course, is the consequence of Measure 5, which if you looked back on the voters' pamphlet in 1990, the discussions about Measure 5, it was all about the schools and who is going to be responsible for the schools. And that was one of the key legacies, is the state share of school funding jumped to 70%. Basically from there. You see there was some variation before, some increase in the early 80s, then the state, of course, with its own fiscal problems, began dropping off in the 80s, and then here's Measure 5, and it shoots up to about 70%, and that's under our current system about where it's going to stay unless you make some major changes. Oregon's new revenue system in terms of the census data, you can see one of the things that we did in response to Measure 5 was reduce our reliance on taxes, increased our federal revenue, and have been a lot more aggressive in using charges in the system. In terms of kind of our volatility over time, that gets a lot of attention, you can see that if you look at kind of this is tax data for all the states from the Rockefeller Center in New York. And you can see that the personal income tax is the strongest grower in the 90s, and we expect that to be the case in the long run, that it's going to grow stronger than these other revenue sources. Here's the impact of the recession. Of course, Oregon, even bigger percentage drop. This is a one-year drop of about 11%. This was unprecedented in the post-war period. Another drop in 2004, and then here we are starting to come back again. And notice where you get even greater volatility is on the corporate. And, you know, looking back, you know, and remembering that this committee meeting here in 2001, we could see the revenue starting to flatten out. But what we really saw, and personal was still okay coming in, forecast didn't change much on May 15. But looking back, what we could really see was corporate was dropping. And it started to drop, and it was not coming in the spring of 01. And it was the early sign that things had gone wrong. And you can see huge drops here percentage-wise. We're not quite sure what the corporate pattern is in the future. Corporate profits now are the highest percentage of total income they've been in 40 years. We don't know exactly why. It's a national phenomenon. It's national profits that drive this green line for all the states. Sales taxes, a lot more stable, not as much volatility, about flat in the recession years, not as much growth in the expansion years. And you can see this even more clearly if you look at, compare our general fund with our neighbors to the north, and you can see that the green line here shows our income tax skyrocketing in the 90s as it did from the capital gains explosion, the stock market bubble. Here's our drop. And see, they had a drop too, but it was less than 1%. So, of course, they had special sessions too, and they had to rebalance and so forth. But this number down here, this green line for our general fund, includes the $450 million that you had to borrow in the spring of 2003 just to get through the budget. That's the appropriation credit bonds that we've used the master settlement revenue stream to repay, and we'll be repaying through 2010, I believe. So that counted as a revenue. So if you take that out, instead of being 7.5%, this is about 12%. So it was an even bigger drop. And of course, Washington didn't make those, that kind of a big borrowing wasn't required. And here they are starting to come back, but we're coming back stronger. And I would think when all is said and done, these are partly projections here, our green line will probably be even higher relative to the red line for them. You know, their revenue is strong because of sales tax, but it just doesn't have that component that really takes off in an expansion, an income component. Okay, kind of a summary of our revenue system, kind of as we see it, kind of a strengths and weaknesses look at it. The income tax, and I do have a chart, if anybody's ever interested, tracking the general fund and income taxes back to 1929, when we first instituted them. And you can see, I mean, in the war years, and then extremely powerful revenue generated over time. The non-tax revenue sources that we've used we saw charges in particular have been made extensive use of in our revenue system. One thing I haven't talked about, and we'll get into this when you look at some proposals, is kind of the distribution of our tax burden. Our tax burden is roughly proportionally distributed. Less progressive than the federal, but more progressive than most other states, Washington being extreme case of regressivity. So without the sales tax, we tend to have a proportional system rather than a regressive one. Appropriate charges, economists think, are good if those charges reflect true costs. And the stability of our local revenue system. The local system, and you'll hear a lot about this as you talk about it, the local system problems are really the exact opposite of the state. It's got a stable revenue source, property taxes, that's very predictable. I was up a couple of weeks ago with the city of Portland and kind of looking over their forecast and their property tax forecast. They got one of the easiest jobs there is on that property tax forecast. It's right about 3% every year. And any incremental growth they get mostly goes into their urban renewal district. So, I mean, it's very stable. Doesn't grow very fast, though. And that's therein lies their... Their concern is it's not rapidly growing and doesn't respond to growth much. Weaknesses at the state level, clearly the instability of the income tax. most economic theory will tell you there's, you know, evidence is mixed on the impact of tax rates at the state level, but in theory we would expect higher marginal tax rates to discourage economic activity, particularly mobile factors of production like high-wage workers, and capital. Federal dependence, and we're seeing this on the timber front, reduces policy control. This issue you've had to confront in terms of looking at the connecting to the federal income tax is another time where you look at that policy issue. Gee, is that what you'd want to do as a state policymaker? The feds, change those dynamics. Excessive charges can create competitive problems and equity problems. A lot of concern around tuition, for example, and whether that prices students out of the higher ed system. And the low growth of the local revenue system. This is what Representative Butler was talking about earlier, that under Measure 50, you're restricted to growth and cannot respond in many times to service needs. Current revenue situation. And you'll be updated on this as we go through the session.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I wanted to ask you a question about the tax incidence model, and I thought of it because of the last slide that you had that talked about the theory about these, you know, what the effect was supposed to be on economic activity. And I've always been curious, you know, we've got these great tools for predicting the effect of various changes that we contemplate in our tax system, but is there any mechanism that looks back then and looks at changes and checks out the accuracy of those predictions?
Ripson Rosenbaum is referring to our OTIM model, Oregon Tax Incidence Model, that was built in 1999, and we have used it since that time. We used it, actually, I had some salary-saving dollars in this interim, and I used those to hire Ed Waters to come back on a contract and help us renew that, update the data, and so forth. So we have a kind of a new and improved version for you. And we do plan to spend some time with you talking about kind of our models we have, and OTIM is the main one. OTIM can, it's, what OTIM does is it's what we call a static equilibrium model. It looks at a system now in place, changes a big policy, a tax policy, and then looks at where it would come to rest in the future, a new, what economists call a new equilibrium. So it's at two points in time, so it's a longer period of time. It's not a forecast model, but it's rather saying, if we change something and everything else stayed the same, where would the system come to rest again? So it is very difficult to test those kind of results because the world doesn't tend to cooperate. All those other things change, and particularly phases of the business cycle and so forth. But we can, there are some ways to look at how we've changed relative to other states. I don't think there's a simple way to come in and say, gee, this prediction was right and that one was wrong. But I think we can at least go back and test to see if the direction and magnitude of those estimates are reasonable compared to history and what happened. And we try to do that when we can, and we'll talk about that when we go through that model with you. The OTIM model, we think, is about... reflects about a five-year period from when we change the system and get results at the end.
Is that responsive?
So on our kind of on our current revenue situation, you're familiar now with the rebounding economy, and once again our income tax is proving itself to be a strong revenue generator in the expansion phase. Of course, the kicker is interacting, and we'll look at those numbers in a minute. The other thing that's coming is the lottery revenue. Lottery revenue is up 35%. So you've got strong revenue growth in both general fund and lottery. But keep in mind, again, the context, and many of you are well aware of, the 2001-03 budget and the revenue decline that we experienced was the sharpest since 33-35. So it was unprecedented. And, of course, I think the question you have to ask yourself, and we'll try to help you as much as we can in addressing it, is that what the future has to hold? I mean, is that indicative of the kind of instability and volatility we're going to see looking out, or is that some kind of one-off event that we don't have to worry about? You can see we're a little worried about it as being reflected. Maybe not, certainly we don't see that stock market bubble we saw before, but we see a lot of other imbalances like the trade deficit, the real estate markets, and other things that suggest we could easily be in a more volatile situation.
Paul, are those amongst the things that we're going to talk about during some of our other preparation sessions as we're dealing with other issues? The issues you raised at the end, the global issues and the national issues, potential risks, that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, we, you know, of course, typically you'll have that discussion with a forecast.
Right.
But we would certainly recommend looking at that and not just listening to us, but bringing in some other outside folks and talk about that in the context of an emergency fund and a reserve fund. One of the debates we think is highly relevant is what should be the size of that fund. Your current education stability fund is a 5% cap, 5% of general fund. Is that appropriate? You know, that depends on that margin of that downside risk. And that's where I think it's important for the committee to talk about those issues and get some good advice on what that might look like. We used to think, and that 5%, frankly, came from us when it was developed by the Special Budget Committee in 2002, because that was the NCSL recommendation at that time. About 5% was about reasonable in terms of the average recession. That's kind of been changed after that recession, and all was said and done, we could see with a 20% decline below our forecast in 0103 that now the NCSL is talking more about 10%, 10 to 12%.
I think that for those of us who were here for five special sessions in 2002, this is an area of some salience.
Yes. The general fund, as you know, is, and this number, by the way, may not be quite as well known, this number is growing. And if you go back to the 50s, pretty steady, it was in the 60%, 70%, and now our projections actually put this up in the low 90s. That's because income tax is growing more than other components. The corporate income tax, in terms of a revenue source, that kind of gives you the worst of both worlds. Its long-term pattern has been essentially flat, inelastic in a long-term sense. It hasn't grown relative to the economy. There's various debates on why that's happened, but it hasn't grown much over time. Yet, in the short run, it's very volatile. So it's slow growing in the long run and volatile in the short run has been its history.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Paul, relative to the elements of personal income tax that we collect, we know that you segregate out the capital gains portion, which isn't truly income, but we'd collect an income tax on. What do you see in addition to the capital gains, which has certainly recovered in the last two biennia? What do you see is the largest personal or largest element, largest segmented portion of the personal income tax? Is it wages? Is it what? Do we know where that's at, Paul?
Wages and salaries are the biggest component. I believe they're about 60 to 65% of the income tax base.
Most growing?
Yes, and that most of that we get from the withholding receipts. But we are seeing more volatility in that component, and the reason is because of the use of bonuses. And those bonuses tend to be withheld at the time, or withheld when they're paid out. So now we're seeing, you know, from an economic stability standpoint, you know, I see that as a good thing for the economy. I was always taught that wage flexibility and price flexibility gives you less unemployment fluctuations. So there's some real positives there. In terms of revenue, it creates more instability because you don't, you know, all of a sudden you're not picking up that bonus income at the end of the year. Prior year you may have gotten a spike. The next year you don't, and it becomes very difficult to predict when that will happen.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard, and I think what I'm looking for here, Paul, is number one, to separate out the capital gains that we collect personal income tax on, because that certainly has grown since it dropped way off precipitously during the recession. Relative to the segment that relates to savings and investing, is that increasing? And if it is, or is it increasing or decreasing? And then what's the effect of that? I guess my concern is, are we saving more in the state of Oregon and creating more income through the interest and dividends on savings and investing, or are we just depending upon the day-to-day W-2 wage income and bonuses?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, what we see happen over time, one of the trends you clearly see is lower interest earnings. And of course, that has to do with interest rates. I mean, interest rates have been low. We've seen a sharp drop, and that, you know, that was a big component back, particularly in the 70s and 80s. That's dropped. Those other components have tended to rise. Schedule E income, for example, which is which oftentimes is S corporation income. Schedule C, which is small business income. Those components have risen relative to the total pie. So we're seeing people earn their money in those kinds of activities and less in the standard wages and salaries.
Finally, if I may, Mr. Chair, then really what you're seeing is less return on investment income in that process, more dependence upon Schedule C earnings, more dependence upon pass-through from S corporations, which are a quasi-current earning, in effect, active earning, as well as wage and bonuses, which are true earnings at that particular point, and less return for a combination of reasons, probably the lower interest rates, but those lower interest rates, we're starting to overcome on some of those now. The rates are starting to come back. I guess my concern is that also then shows us the instability of our own society, that we are not saving as much as we used to as well.
Well, that's certainly correct. You know, our saving rate is among the lowest in the industrialized world. But we're in, and this I think is probably a subject maybe for a full meeting, but mm-hmm. we're in a world where we appear to have almost a glut in savings because world interest rates are very low, when with the introduction of a much bigger labor force into the world through globalization, we would think that the cost of capital would go up because we've got so much more labor out there. Yet we haven't really seen that happen. And I think that has to do with the dynamics of where the saving is taking place, particularly in Asia.
Right.
And that's what's holding world interest rates down, and that's what's showing up in those lower interest earnings. But we as a nation, and certainly as a state, have a relatively low saving rate compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, a few minutes ago you mentioned that the corporate excise tax was sort of the worst of both worlds, as vulnerable and slow growth. And you mentioned on the slow growth side that there's debate in various schools of thought why that is. Can you briefly tell us what those schools of thought are with that?
Representative Bruin, there are a series of things. One is we have seen a kind of a long-term secular decline in the profit share until recent years, until we've seen the jump. So that the profit share of national income was declining. There's a lot of speculation about corporations organizing themselves in ways that reduce state tax burden. You have a spatially fixed government, i.e. the state, and a corporation that, you know, that is worldwide. So there can be ways to design your systems where your costs and where your income flows occur that will minimize taxes. And of course, there's been a lot of effort to do that. A lot of it perfectly legal, some of it questionable. There's been a lot of competition among the states, and you've heard the debate here in our own legislature about what kind of competition is there for capital. Again, as spatially fixed states are saying, how can we grow? Well, you grow by attracting resources, and capital is the most mobile of the resources. So we've seen a lot of interstate competition, and that's probably been another one of the factors that has held down corporate long-term growth. We do, however, not only see it at the state level, but at the federal level, too. Mm-hmm. We've seen the federal level a drop, particularly compared to the personal income. And some of that may be due to organizational changes. We mentioned the subchapter S, for example, where you end up paying through the personal income tax when you're really, we think about 10% of the personal income tax is really business income through partnerships and subchapter S and so forth.
Thank you.
Okay, back to the general fund and lottery. And, of course, lottery now has become video in terms of dollars. Mm-hmm. We still talk about them and the various traditional games, but it's really video. The other thing to keep in mind about lottery, and we'll talk in detail with you about this, is that about half of it is available for discretionary allocation. The rest of it is either debt service, the lottery-backed bonds that were sold in 97 and 99. You have a proposal from the governor to some more lottery-backed bonds. The Education Stability Fund's picking up 18% of those earnings. Parks and Natural Resources, about 15%. So there's also dedication to the counties, 2.5% county economic development, for example. And there's some statutory dedications. Current economic outlook, I won't spend too much time talking about this, just to emphasize that things are certainly better than they have been, and our state growth has picked up, but we also know that there's a series of risks out there, and as state economists told the interim committee on December 1, we expect 07 to be a weaker year than either 05 or 06. And as the chair alluded to, there are a series of risks out there, and I won't really go into these. Housing prices we see as the most immediate risk. One of the things that Measure 50 has done for the revenue system is protect the revenue system against this downside risk. I think there would definitely be more risk of a housing bubble to local revenue if we were under the old market value-based system. That's the stability side of Measure 50. This is my own personal worry. I think it's very hard for a country to continually run record deficits. At some point, there needs to be an adjustment. That adjustment could end up being abrupt and painful for our consumers and businesses. International tensions. Well, we don't have Representative Boquist on the committee this time to fill us in on those. we know that's a risk. General fund revenue, you'll see the numbers on what the outlook is. Here's our growth back up really to the 90s kind of level. And this surprised us. We were expecting a rebound, expecting some return to strong growth, but not back to these kind of bubble type years out here. So 23% is what we're looking at now from last biennium right here. This is minus 0.8%. That's all kicker. Because kicker, remember, the kicker affects revenue stream. Doesn't affect expenditures, doesn't affect this biennium, affects next biennium's revenue. And then, of course, that distorts this number. This number is really 12% if you take out the kicker distortion. One of the things I've done in that research report is I went through and I calculated historically what the kicker has been. I took out all the legislative actions that modified the kicker. When it was suspended, when the Muffle decision was made in 01, there were some other decisions made on the safe payments and long sorted history there. Pulled those out, assuming those are not realistic to assume for the future under the Constitution, and estimated that on average the kicker will cost the general fund budget 3%. The current kicker projection is 10.9% of 2007-09 revenue. So that's a record level. Really, by any measure. Here's the biggest we've had in the past. And this 3%, as you look out, for example, 09-11, that's about 500 million. The outlook going ahead, you can see kind of where the numbers are bouncing around here. The 03-05, the change in 05-07, again, is about 23% for resources. Lottery has jumped almost 37% as we see an even stronger acceptance of the line games than we expected. We were looking at about 8% growth over time, about 12% from the line games for about 20% total. We're up to 37 now, so you can see the increase there above what we expected. As we look to 07-09, there's the effect of the kicker on both personal. Corporate is expected to flatten out with a kicker turn negative. Your resource picture doesn't look that much more than where we are right now. You've got resource lottery slowing down a little bit, but you've got about 8.4% increase in general fund lottery resources available compared to what you've got now. But the thing to keep in mind is what you've got now, this $14.1 billion, you're only spending about less than $13 billion of that. Because a lot of that money you didn't expect. Because it's revenues way above projections from last regular session. So if you look at what you're spending in terms of total general fund lottery and compare it to what you could spend out of this total, pulling out Education Stability Fund, assuming about $150 million in ending balance, it's about a 19.5% increase. So that's why, the spending picture looks good. The resource picture doesn't look that good in terms of just percentage growth from where we are now. It's just that you did not spend what you have now because you didn't really have it. And that's basically kind of the situation you're in right now. Okay, my last slide is on are we ready for the next rainy day? And we'll spend some more time talking about the Education Stability Fund. You'll probably get some proposals to look at that constitutional fund. The thing about the line games and the lottery revenue coming in,
Well, that's 18% of that's going into that fund, so it's growing faster than we thought. When it was first considered by the legislature, we said, nah, 13, 15, maybe you'd hit the 5%, thinking that we're bound to have a recession before then. Now we're looking at 09, 11 is when you hit the 5% cap. So that's an issue I think that's going to be upon you, and one you may want to, this would be the session to talk about what you want to do with those dollars, if you want to change the current cap, if you want to develop that capital matching fund. The Senate has a proposal to try to flush that out a little bit. And then again, the last kind of sobering reminder here is the drop in revenue in 0103 compared to the forecast was 20.6%. That was about $2.4 billion.
Paul, I think one of the things that we may be asking you about or others about is you mentioned earlier that NCSL had suggested that a 5% reserve was a reasonable amount. What is the real reasonable amount based on the conditions, the historical conditions, and what we know about our taxing system? And I don't expect an answer to that today, but something that you and the people who you consult with might address as we think about a potential emergency reserve account and how much that ought to grow to. What would be a prudent amount and what would be more or less a maximum amount? Because I know those might be different numbers from a planning standpoint. And I really appreciate your last comment. I didn't know that we were looking at filling up the Education Stability Fund that soon. But in my personal opinion, at least that 5% is probably low for what we need as a stability fund, let alone an emergency fund that might be required to cover a tsunami or a Katrina event or an earthquake or something, which, as you recall, is one of the things that we can draw from that account for.
Right. The legislature can declare an emergency. It doesn't have to be economically related. It doesn't even have to have a shortfall in your projections. The legislature can declare an emergency. The one thing you have to have on any access to the fund is a three-fifths vote.
It's a three-fifths vote.
Three-fifths vote is required regardless. So that's a constant. It takes three-fifths of both chambers.
Right. Well, what that means, of course, is that we won't be spending the money on things that fall outside the purview of the fund.
That's the intent.
Right. Representative Berger, did you have something?
Nope.
No. Anything else today? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you consider 5% emergency fund for a rainy day to operate the state, that's a lot of money, and we're a long ways away from it. But if you were to consider a 5% emergency fund for yourself and your own household, that does not make the next house payment. I mean, it requires an 8%, an eight and a fraction percent, just to take care of the next month. So I would certainly concur with you, Mr. Chair, that while 5%, sounds good and feels good, it's a starting point. It's a starting point, and I think that it would be an appropriate kind of thing for us to discuss. And I just leaned over before you asked that question to Representative Rosenbaum and asked her if she would feel comfortable with a larger number, and I think she did concur that we would both want to consider a larger number.
Thank you, Representative. Anything else for today?
If not, we're adjourned.